Don't lie about a rock and roll, it's been many, many ways in which a society is gagged. One is gagging by law. One is gagging by outlaws. That is the extra legal, illegal, violent means of gagging that take place. Third is the gagging by corporate media. Then there is the fourth, that is the gagging that comes with big money and huge inequality. And the last is the gagging by self-censorship.
That's P. Sainath, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features P. Sainath, Gagging Democracy, India Style. India, the world's most populous country, is ruled by Narendra Modi, who is the head of the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP. He first became prime minister in 2014 and has been re-elected twice since, though in 2024 with much lower margins. Before coming to power in Delhi, he was chief minister of the state of Gujarat, where he presided over a major massacre of Muslims. Modi and the BJP promote Hindutva, Hindu majoritarianism. It is laced with Islamophobia. Modi is allied with India's billionaire class, who control the country's major media and function as cheerleaders for a regime that gags democracy, free speech, and dissent. Our guest today is P. Sainath. He's an award-winning journalist who writes about rural India. "I cover the people," he says, "who live at the bottom end of the spectrum." He's the founding editor of PARI, the People's Archive of Rural India. He gave the Hari Sharma Memorial Lecture at the Surrey Public Library in Surrey, British Columbia, in early October. And now, P. Sainath, Gagging Democracy, India Style.
A few months ago, just before the national elections, our Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, discovered and declared that he had understood after his mother's passing that he was not biologically born. Yeah? And had in fact been installed by God to show all the rest of us whatever he has been showing us. So, when we are talking about governance by gagging, and I'm going to race a bit, there are many, many ways in which a society is gagged. And one of them you saw immediately after that wonderful statement of the Prime Minister. Not a single newspaper wrote a single editorial, not a single anchor on any channel made any kind of critical comment when the head of the nation says that he is non-biologically born. You know, it's just as if they didn't hear it. He said it out loud and clear. The gagging is of a particular, of one of the five types that I'm going to talk about. One is gagging by law. One is gagging by outlaws. That is the extra legal, illegal, violent means of gagging that take place. Third is the gagging by corporate media, which, like in the case of the Prime Minister's not biologically born and of divine origin. I mean, I think there were at least some interesting doctrines to be gone into when you are of divine origin. Then there is the fourth, that is the gagging that comes with big money and huge inequality, which to my mind is the main source of the gagging, because it didn't just start on 2014 with Mr. Modi. That's not true. That's not accurate. It's been going on. It's raced in the time of Mr. Modi, but ever since we embraced neoliberalism in 1991, the different sources of gagging have grown immeasurably. And the last is the gagging by self-censorship. The fear, how many people who know better are remaining silent because it's bloody prudent and sensible to remain silent. Okay, so those are broadly the five ways. Let me show you the first, gagging by laws. And, you know, one of the ways of silencing people is that it requires just the selective silence of the judiciary. Would you believe that the Delhi High Court has held that Inquilab Zindabad is an incendiary and inflammatory statement, and you can go to jail for it if they feel that you used it in a violent context? Inquilab Zindabad, coined by Maulana Hasrat Mohani, was the rallying cry of the Indian freedom struggle. Long live the revolution. Here is the Delhi High Court. This is in the case of poor Umar Khaled. Umar Khaled has been denied bail I don't know how many times. And one of his problems, of course, is that he has a Muslim name. That's a serious issue and indicative, doubtless, of criminality. So look at what they're saying here. Huh? During the course of argument, issues were raised relating to the content, context, and use of certain phraseology in the speech of the appellant. This is the High Court of Delhi, which prima facie appeared to be incriminating per se, as inflammatory. The court goes on to say, however, this court is not impressed by the argument of the appellant, inasmuch as the call to revolution does not have to affect only the immediate gathering. The call to revolution may affect many beyond those who were visibly present, which is why this court finds it apt to mention Robespierre, who was in the vanguard of the French Revolution. This court is of the view that possibly, if the appellant had referred to Maximilien Robespierre for what he meant by revolution, he must have also known what revolution meant for our freedom fighter and first prime minister. The very fact that Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru believed that democracy had made revolution superfluous, by the way, Nehru used that slogan many times himself in the 30s. That democracy has made revolution superfluous after independence, and how it meant to the complete opposite of a bloodless change. Revolution isn't by itself always bloodless, which is why it is contradistinctly used with the prefix of bloodless revolution. So when we use the expression revolution, it is not necessarily bloodless. They're finding a way to say that Umar Khaled's slogan, Inquilab Zindabad, which is in every Indian trade union meeting that you can imagine at the beginning and at the end, was somehow an incitement to violence. A revolution in its essential quality may not be different, but from the point of view of Robespierre and Pandit Nehru, in its potentiality, blah, blah. The accompanying documents, and in view of the discussions herein, only for the limited percent of the present bail, this court expresses the inescapable conclusion that allegations against the appellant are prima facie true. And hence, the embargo created by section whatever of the UAPA is the most draconian of laws, Unlawful Activities Prevention Act in India, under which they brought to this horrible law of 1967, they brought amendments in 2019, which enable the police to charge or government to characterize an individual as terrorist. That was actually meant for organizations. They can now term anyone, an individual, a terrorist. And like they have with Umar Khaled and others. Thus, the appellant's application seeking regular bail is rejected. Did you ever believe that in your lifetime that a court would say Inquilab Zindabad is incriminatory and inflammatory? So there you are with this incredible situation where hundreds of people are arrested arbitrarily, they don't get bail. Meanwhile, when someone else comes up who is not objectionable to the government, the court issues bail with pious injunctions like bail is the rule, jail is the exception. A Supreme Court judge has gone on record saying that in the UAPA, jail is the rule, bail is the exception. On October 3, we observed the first anniversary of the biggest raid on journalists in Indian history. there was much worse done to journalists under colonial rule, and there were a lot of terrible things done to journalists during the political emergency of 75-79. But it never happened. It never happened that 46 journalists associated with a single publication in a single city were raided by nearly 500 policemen at dawn. This was the journalists associated with NewsClick. Also, every electronic device they owned was confiscated. Some of them have still not got it back. Hard disks, laptops, mobile phones, the whole works. And the courts did not raise a finger to protest against this. Yeah. So there you have one very clear form of gagging. If you look at this, the court holds that the Delhi police charge of terrorism against Umar Khalid are prima facie true. And therefore, there is no way it will give him bail. This is the High Court of Delhi. In the emergency, you know, every year, every June 25th, all over India, we have commemorative meetings to remember the declaration of the emergency, June 25, 1975, and that we shall never have it again. Now, the tragedy with this, as much as I attend those meetings and make speeches at them myself, the tragedy is every year, that single day, we ritualize our remembrance of the emergency. Every year, on that single day, we ritualize our rejection of the emergency. But almost every day, every year since, we institutionalize our embrace of it through new laws, through amendments, like the Unlawful Activities Public. So we've rebuilt emergency in far more lethal form through a number of little laws and amendments and stuff. Yeah, some of which I'll come to when we come to corporate media and how the government works in sync with it. What do we mean by governance, by gagging? We have seen the laws. By the way, governance is no longer refers to governments alone. There are many other institutional players in governance. There is corporate governance. There's all sorts of... I will only look at these five which I have told you about. But I want to also say that there is a very brave, feisty, combative, independent media in India. But their size is restricted. Their support is restricted. They have no revenues to speak of. And yet, you know, we hear about all the doctrines of journalism and what we are supposed to do. I have come to hate this cliche, speaking the truth to power. I really hate it. You know, somehow it's such a wimpish little thing. As if power is so naive, poor things, it's just that they don't know what's right. Yeah, and if we talk to them the truth to power, they will set everything right. Power knows much better than any one of us what's going on. When much of what is going on the way it is because power wants it to happen that way. Okay? My exhortation to all of you, if it pleases you, by all means speak the truth to power. A lot of journalists fancy themselves as advisors to prime ministers and things. By all means, if it pleases you, speak the truth to power. The far more important thing every citizen has got to do, especially the media, speak the truth about power. Speak the truth to people about power. So we come to the gagging in the second form, the violence, the illegal, the extra-legal gaggings that go on. And the best example, on which I don't have to even say more once I tell you the word, Manipur. The kind of violence in Manipur, the incredible bloodshed. Not even do you, your prime minister has not visited once in a year. I think that the advisors look around for, on the map, on the globe, is there any country or island he has not yet visited? But, so that he can go there, you know, and open a temple or something. But he hasn't made a visit to Manipur to condole with the people of Manipur who have lost how many lives we don't know, apart from God knows some 200 churches or something burned down or demolished or damaged. That kind of violence, and the kind of violence unleashed by the frontal organizations of the ruling party. And in fact, I promised a friend here that I would dwell on this point a little bit, because people always ask me, I get emails, etc. When you talk about the violence by the VHP, the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, or the Bajrang Dal, or anyone else, very often the BJP response is, they are not part of the BJP, they are fraternal friends or whatever, but we don't know, I mean, we don't speak for them, except when what they've done is something that the BJP takes credit for. So I keep getting asked this question, is there no difference between the RSS, BJP, VHP, Bajrang Dal? Is there a difference? I believe there's a very serious difference. The RSS is the mothership. The BJP is the RSS on politics. The VHP is the BJP on steroids. And the Bajrang Dal is the VHP on crack. Big difference. Huge difference. This is the difference in the Parivar frontal organizations, etc. Incidentally, the last speech at which I said this, that disappeared from the internet. And what a horrible term the media use when they are demolishing the houses of poor people in Ayodhya, elsewhere, mostly Muslims, but also others, including in Ayodhya, it includes a number of Hindus, because that's becoming a real estate scam. And rich people from Delhi are investing a lot of money in land in Ayodhya, yeah, and making rentals and all that prohibitively expensive for locals, right? So the extent of these demolitions, the media calls it bulldozer justice. And many progressives use this term. There can be no connection between bulldozing a poor person's home and the word justice. What this is bulldozer terror. It is terrorism, it is bulldozer terror, and it is state-driven bulldozer terror. Okay. The Supreme Court has finally, after sitting like a sphinx on the issue for I don't know how long, said that there will be no further demolitions anywhere in the country except without its being referred to this court. Very nice. And yesterday another bench of them said that the demolitions going on in one particular part of India are exempted because we're not going to give a stay order on the lower court's permission for the demolitions, whatever. Selective silence of the judiciary is all that's required. Having made a great pronouncement and congratulated in the newspaper editorials for stopping, saying no more of this, after hundreds if not thousands of homes of people not aligned with the ruling party have suffered from that. And again, at every stage, in both the first two categories that I spoke to you about, you see how critical the role of the media is. The media that accepted blandly our Prime Minister's divine origin, the same media never said a word in 2015. Barely a year after he assumed power, he inaugurated the Reliance Health Foundation, where he made this absolutely phenomenal speech. I did not see editorials criticizing it either, where he declared that ancient India, 20, 30, God knows how many thousand years ago, obviously knew plastic surgery. Otherwise, how do you explain the elephant head on Ganesha's body. Okay? This is the Prime Minister of India. And you remember, we are the greatest in everything. Now, the newspapers reported it. Please, you can just Google it and see. Newspapers reported it. Independent media criticized it, ridiculed it, to no avail. Yeah, at one level, it is a never-ending source of entertainment. But when you got to live with it and take the consequences of it, it becomes a gagging when nobody speaks up. Another question people ask me is, who is your first hero in journalism? My first hero in journalism was the kid who said, hey, the emperor is stark naked. Now, what he said was already in the public domain. Yeah? But the courtiers were busy explaining, understanding that the gold weave was so fine that it was not visible to the human eye. And that was my first hero in journalism. The kid who said the emperor is naked. How much we need kids like that. You're not going to find them in the corporate media, which has been... Now, look at the strength, the power of this corporate media. The Indian corporate media, meaning its corporate ownership, the bulk of circulation, the bulk of channels, everything are corporate owned. And these corporations are into hundreds of different areas of manufacturing, production, trade, etc., which give rise to unimaginable levels of conflict of interest. So you've just got absolutely no control on what you don't, we don't have, even in the United States, they have laws on cross-ownership, which are easily broken ever since Reagan came to power. But there were laws on cross-ownership. You could not be the only game in town, only newspaper, only portal, only radio station, only TV station in town. You could not be. So what you did was went and had mergers somewhere else so that you could still be. But at least there was a bloody law. We have no law against cross-ownership or anything of the sort. India's richest man is Mukesh Ambani, the 12th richest man in the world or whatever. So Mukesh Ambani, he had a wedding for his son, including the prequel, sequel, and all that. It cost more than $500 million. And that wedding was held in a state of Maharashtra where many suicides of farmers are linked to the inability of the family to conduct their daughter's wedding. Okay? I've done stories on that. Yeah? And in that state, you hold this wedding with, you know, an 800-pound gorilla wedding. When the farm agitation took place, did your media ever tell you that this was the largest struggle for justice on the face of the earth in 30 years? Peaceful, constitutional, legal, democratic protest. Yeah? Let me take another struggle whose idealism I admired and respected and still do in North America. In 2011, you had the Occupy Wall Street movement where thousands of very idealistic youngsters, many of them techies, occupied Zuccotti Park in New York. They had a fantastic impact and they coined one of the greatest slogans, 1% versus the 99%. It had an impact across the United States. More than 400 towns had similar sit-ins, you know, Occupy Atlanta, etc. Many people being evicted by their councils got support locally in different small American cities to occupy the properties and not be thrown out, not be evicted. All this is great. And it got a phenomenal amount of publicity because it was there in Wall Street. Though, by the way, for the first 2 weeks, as it began to unfold, the New York Times simply ignored it. They said very little about it. Anyway, at the end of 9 weeks, the mayor of New York told the NYPD, throw the scumbags out. In hours, NYPD cleared Zuccotti Park. In 24 hours, there was no trace of the agitation. In India, 100,000 farmers gathered at the gates of Delhi from Punjab, from Haryana, and some representation from 20 other states. They gathered at Delhi. They were met with a violence that you would not believe. The Border Security Force, the CISF, Central Industrial Security Force, the CRPF, the Punjab Police, the Delhi Police, the Haryana Police, all of them. Do you know what the government of India did? It broke its own laws on destruction of public property, whereby if you go around smashing things on the road or the lights, you'll be put in jail and charged a gigantic fine. To stop the farmers from entering Delhi, they dug 20-foot by 10-foot trenches in the national highways and then go to the court saying that the farmers are blocking traffic to Delhi. The farmers at the agitation were met with ice-cold water cannon in Delhi's worst winter in 40 years. One 78-year-old, one 80-year-old died of that within 3 days of being hit by icy cold water cannon. Remember that these people were all sleeping in the open. The farmers were attacked with tear gas. Incidentally, this February 12th, look it up in your newspapers if you don't believe me. We're the first, right? We're the greatest, we're the best. We became the first nation to use drone warfare against our own farmers. Yeah? Spider drones, you know those things which have clasps, spider feet, with carrying tear gas canisters, it was dropped on them, at the Punjab-Haryana border. Incidentally, one of them bounced off the head of a journalist and sent him to hospital. No protests in the media about that, but at least it was reported that this happened. Another journalist also got injured by the tear gas canisters. Now, all these methods of tear gas, you name it. Oh, they not only dug those giant trenches, they brought God knows how many kilometers of concertina wire. Do you know what concertina wire is? It's that barbed wire that opens out like an accordion. So you can stretch it across very large distances. Huge bales of concertina wire were opened. And with all this, they could not beat down those farmers. Those farmers remained there for 54 weeks until they threw the damn laws out. The farmers were scoring a significant victory against corporate media. Whatever happened there did not happen because brave journalists said things, though some of us were regular speakers at the camps. They built their own township, Singhu, Tikri. They built their own townships around Delhi and protested. You know, the enthusiasm it roused, 3,000 farmers went from Maharashtra to join them and opened their own camp at Shah Jahanabad, the border of Rajasthan, Haryana. Shahjahanpur. So, on one occasion, when some of us went around the Singhu camp, and there was a little group there that did a survey, 21 languages were spoken in that camp in Singhu. Of course, the maximum number were from Punjab and Haryana. They are approximately the closest states. Of course, there are going to be more from there than anywhere else. 2,000 came from Nashik, from just one union, the Kisan, All India Kisan Sabha. And you know what many of these volunteers from other states were doing? They were volunteering for kitchen duty. You can read all these stories in the one website that created a category just for protests, farmers' protests, People's Archive of Rural India. And you'll see little kids peeling peas in the Rajasthan camp and little Fateh Singh, 3-year-old, peeling peas with his mom for the cooking in the Shahjahanpur camp. Not one newspaper, not one channel would even mention that the main slogans of the farmers were naming Mr. Ambani and the second richest Indian, Mr. Adani. You know, a lot of these Punjabis and farmers have a Fauji background. They conducted one operation and took out